Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how soy, not genetically engineered, but organic soy, can reduce a major disease, how zinc can help women, how using a multiple vitamin can allow longer telomeres. I'll explain what a telomere is and why that's important. How higher vitamin D will help men with prostate. How green tea prevents periodontal disease. How DHA, that's what you find in the omega-3 fatty acids, reduces tumor growth. How alpha-lipoic acid and affects triglycerides. And also coenzyme Q10, what it does. Lutein improves something. So we have the latest, all from peer-reviewed journals and always at the cutting edge. Today we're also going to explore an issue that I think is important. We're going to have a point-counterpoint. The point is universities are now making an official policy that any statement against Israel is anti-Semitic. So let's say you have a legitimate concern as a professor or student about Zionist policies. No longer. A lot of trouble coming your way. And this is also being done with our own U.S. Senate. I'll tell you about that. Counterpoint, Chris Hedges from Truthdig, why I support the divestment movement against Israel. So we have two different perspectives, and I'll share both of those. A few days ago, at the end of the show, I opened it up for some talk back, and a gentleman called in and made a comment, I'll paraphrase it, that when you look back at Isaac Newton and great minds from history, you see how much we have used and they should be appreciated for their achievements. But then look at the Native American. They haven't done anything. And because I was out of time, I did not have a chance to respond. Today, I will respond. And for all of you who are unaware of what Native Americans have achieved that we can benefit from, nothing, as some believe, or a great deal, that will be my own commentary. Also today, we will take a look at biophotons. Biophotons are very important, and I'll put it this way. Someone walks up onto a stage to give a lecture, to perform, to sing, whatever it is, and sometimes we are just captivated, not necessarily by what they're sharing with us, but by them, the person. Sometimes we look at a person, and it could be a stranger, and it's just like something lights up. And we've heard people say, you light up my life, you know, my heart lit up. Well, that's the biophotons, and I'll explain how our cells and DNA use biophotons to store and communicate information from Sayer G. Grimm MedInfo. Also from our environmental segment today, not a fishtail, humans are ingesting plastics thanks to ocean pollution, and we'll give you the reasons why pesticides should not be used, and there's some good economic reasons. Also, if time permits today, we're going to have you hear a short interview with a farmer. Now, this is a chicken farmer, and he blows the whistle on chicken farms. You know, he says, quote, there is greed and there's cruelty. And that's now why he is a vegan, but he was a chicken farmer. And he takes you behind the scenes. And so you think cage-free, it doesn't mean anything. We'll tell you about that. Also, it's good when people stand up to a person who is clearly exercising anti-Muslim bigotry. Ted Cruz gets called out to his face. You'll hear this. Also, I want to introduce, on an occasional basis, people who think very deeply. We may not always understand everything they're saying in that moment, but if we let it resonate, it starts to it starts to seep into our consciousness, our deeper consciousness. Today, Alan Watts on choice. Those are some of the things we're going to cover. As you see, we have a packed show. So let's begin. There is a campaign against soy. Now, if you're saying genetically engineered soy, if you're saying soy that is used to destroy rainforest, to plant, so it can be shipped off to feed the growing people want more westernized diets, high meat diets in China, in India, I understand that. I support that. But if you're saying organically grown soy, grown to be consumed not by animals, but by humans as an inexpensive, high-quality protein, double the protein of wheat, double the protein, triple the protein of rye or barley, then I would offer a challenge. I would like to ask those who support the Weston Price Foundation and others who believe in a high-protein paleo diet, please give an opportunity to read the actual scientific literature. Even do it objectively. Exclude anything where there is a bias, meaning where someone paid for the research. And what you have left are thousands upon thousands, nearly 5,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature showing that soy is extremely important and has been to cultures such as the Chinese, the Japanese, the Korean for a long time. This is just the latest from the peer-reviewed journal Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers, and Prevention. They report that Asian American women who consume high amounts of soy during childhood have a lesser risk of developing breast cancer than those women who consume less soy. And this was done at the National Cancer Institute, and they examined a lot of women with and without breast cancer, and they found that there was a 58% lower risk of breast cancer if women ate soy. Now, when they're suggesting eating soy, they're not saying that all day long you're eating soy. They're not saying you have to eat it in every meal. But they're suggesting that soy be a part of your overall healthy diet. And the science is there to support it. The science is not there to support an animal-based diet. So for those who are following the Weston Price Foundation diet, show me the articles in the scientific literature, peer-reviewed literature, where eating meat extends your lifespan or prevents disease. Show me your articles. I have 5,000 articles I can show you on a plant-based diet. I have a major, major new film coming out on this very topic. So you may have a belief, and it may be an honest belief, that the paleo diet, the meat-based diet, is good for you, but it's not based upon science or truth. For women who want to help prevent diabetes, and new research shows that a high zinc intake, let's say 20 milligrams, can help reduce the risk of type 2 diabetes. This was with 82,297 women, mainly nurses in the Nurses' Health Study, and they reviewed years' worth of work, and you have a substantial reduction in diabetes if you're taking your zinc each day. They were followed up for 24 years. So I'm suggesting 20 milligrams a day at the high end, 10 milligrams at the low end of zinc per day. And that can make an enormous difference. This was published in Diabetes Care. One of the ways that we live a longer life is in a simple process that allows the end of your chromosomes to have a cap, much like the end of your shoestrings has a little cap to keep it from fraying. That cap is called a telomeres. And the telomere length determines how long you're going to live. All other things being equal, when they shorten, you die. It's that simple. Now, there are reasons why it shortens and there are reasons why it stays longer. If you exercise each day, longer. If you meditate, relax, are conscious, if you're happy, longer. If you eat a plant-based, healthy, organic diet, longer. If you're in a quality relationship, longer. If you're in a bad relationship, shorter. If you're depressed, lonely, anxious, fearful, angry, rageful, much shorter. If you don't exercise, sedentary, shorter. If you're around electromagnetic appliances like cell phones and microwaves and televisions and computers, shorter. If you work or live in a toxic environment, shorter. If you have a meat-based and processed diet, shorter. So it's relatively simple. And the problem is that most people don't do everything bad, and they certainly don't do everything good. They'll do a token good and bad. And that's the average person today. This is the latest study as published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. What they did is they conducted research through the National Institutes of Health, and they provided the first epidemiological evidence that the use of multiple vitamins by women is associated with longer telomeres. That's good. The protective caps at the end of chromosomes that shorten with the aging of the cell. If you're taking your vitamins, vitamin C, B complex, zinc, minerals like magnesium and calcium, and coenzyme Q10, you are going to live a longer life. Now, it doesn't matter that 99% of doctors in America are unaware of vitamins. Don't look at the science. We have over 500,000 studies on our side. They have ignorance and hubris on their side, yet they win the day because we assume that because they have a medical training, they are smarter. We assume that we should always defer to a person in an authority position. That's a deadly assumption. So for those of you who've been taking your vitamins, you're going to live a longer life than your doctor who's not. Because this, you're going to have longer telomeres, they're going to have shorter. So they can be right, and they'll win, and death is their victory. And you can be wrong, and you'll live a longer life, and that's your victory. It's just something we don't think about. Quote from this study, "Our study provides preliminary evidence linking multiple vitamin use to a longer leukocyte white blood cell telomeres. And that concerns aging and the etiology of disease. Also, higher vitamin D levels are associated with a lower prostate cancer diagnosis in the British Journal of Cancer. Investigators concluded that men with medium to high serum levels of vitamin D, that's good, 3 to 5,000 units a day, had a better chance of surviving prostate cancer compared to men with the lowest levels of the sunshine vitamin. So get your vitamin D. And in that concept of getting your nutrients, alpha lipoic acid reduces triglycerides, that's good, and is a model for obesity and diabetes. That's even better. This was published in the Archives of Biochemistry and Biophysics. It reports that the antioxidant compound alpha lipoic, L-I-P-O-I-C, acid, I would say 600 to 900 milligrams a day, lowers triglycerides. Why do you want that? Because triglycerides, when they're elevated, almost are always elevated in people who have diabetes or overweight, and that will contribute to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, premature death, and atherosclerosis. This was done at Oregon State University's Linus Pauling Institute. So, and they use 200 milligrams. I'm suggesting three times that. And green tea is helpful to prevent periodontal disease. That's good. This is published in the Journal of Parentology, Volume 80. It says, quote, dietary intake of green tea helps reduce the risk of periodontal, which is gum disease. And then DHA, that's what you get in the omega-3 fatty acids, reduces tumor growth. This is in cell division. Researchers report that the omega-3 fatty acid, specifically the fraction called DHA, not only offers its own protection against tumor growth, but improves the chemotherapeutic effect of cisplatin while reducing its toxicity. This was done at Mansoura University in Japan. And they were only using 250 milligrams of DHA, which is a relatively small amount. I would have suggested about three times that amount. Inadequate heart disease prevention in Europe, in spite of the Mediterranean medication use. And this is in The Lancet, quote, despite the ever-escalating use of antihypertensive and lipid-lowering drugs, high blood pressure and abnormally high blood lipid levels remain alarmingly common among heart disease patients. Well, let's just figure this out. All the energy went into giving them drugs and diagnosing, getting them on statins and blood pressure-lowering medications. You didn't put the publicity, the money and the resources in prevention, showing how garlic and onions and chalice, the sulfur group, can lower blood pressure. You didn't put in there how the oils, olive oil, and how greens, kale and parsley, can help keep the blood thin and prevent epithelial damage. You didn't talk about grapes and resveratrol helping with the polyphenols to rejuvenate the cells. So you put all your energy into the wrong place. You put nothing into prevention. We need prevention. Broccoli sprouts fight ulcer bacteria. From cancer prevention research done at Tokyo University of Science, they found that broccoli sprouts, you can grow them yourself for about 7 cents a little container, or buy them for several dollars a container. It only takes about a week to grow them. They kill and suppress the Helicobacter pylori, the bacterium responsible for stomach ulcers and stomach cancer. So, want to help protect your stomach if you have ulcers? Take broccoli sprouts and add in cabbage juice. Have a salad with broccoli sprouts and then drink afterwards with cabbage juice. That will make an enormous difference. Oh, and B-complex is beneficial for celiac disease. This is from the World Journal of Gastroenterology, volume 28. Quote, B vitamin supplementation reduces blood levels of homocysteine, an amino acid implicated in cardiovascular disease among patients with celiac disease. Celiac disease is a digestive disorder characterized by an abnormal immune response to gluten, a protein found in wheat, and poor absorption of nutrients. Malabsorption of B vitamins due to celiac disease often results in ulcerative or elevated homocysteine. End quote. So, just take a B complex with vitamin B6, 25 milligrams, folate, 1 milligram, B12, 1 milligram, and down comes your homocysteine, and if you have celiac, that could be a lifesaver. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome everyone. Had a long day traveling yesterday, but got an awful lot achieved. I'll be back in New York in about 10 weeks. And during the summer and fall and early winter, I'll be premiering a total of 5 new full-feature films on very important issues that will impact our lives. So it's going to be a busy time. Also, I've gotten new material in on autism and vaccines just this morning. So I'm taking a little extra time today to update the new article that will be posted on my website, on GaryNall.com, on my Facebook, and on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. It'll be entitled, Killing the Messengers, Uncovering the Cover-Up on the Autism Vaccine Link. If you will notice, all of the references are from peer-reviewed journals. You could take my article and put it into a class action lawsuit, or you could present it in court and they would not be able to have their expert dismiss it. It's that powerful. It's the final piece of information for those of you who continue to believe there's no proof vaccines are implicated with autism. All the evidence is in the article. And I'm hopeful to get it up sometime later today or tonight. That's coming. Now we're going to listen to a farmer, a chicken farmer. Talk about what it's really like. It's a short clip, but what you're not seeing is reporters inside this giant barn. I'm guesstimating there's several hundred thousand chickens in that barn. And she can't even take the ammonia that's in there. Listen to what he has to say.
Notoriously hard to access if you're not already involved in the industry. But one American farmer, contracted to a meat processing company, has thrown open the barn doors and revealed some of the trade's darkest secrets to our correspondent, Maria Fanoshina.
They are basically putting stuff on labels and putting stuff in advertisements that is so far removed from what's actually happening in those barns. The birds are causing diseases, and that bacteria, that's an entry point for it. It's got to affect the meat. There's just no way it can't. It was like nonstop E. coli, salmonella, people getting sick, and I'm sure some people died from it. The bedding is basically a mixture of dirt, sawdust, their feces is bacteria laden. Without something in that feed, those birds couldn't survive.
What do you think is there?
Actually, it's the pharmaceuticals that would be in that feed. And they, and it doesn't matter whether it's no antibiotics or antibiotics, they're still getting drugs. It's just not classified as antibiotics.
It's not that everything is growing so fast. It's there are certain parts that are growing fast. It's the breast meat that they've been bred for to be plumper. The side effect of that big breast is the organs cannot function properly to keep up with that rapid growth, meaning their organs give out, meaning heart attacks.
How many die, let's say, a day?
A day?
No, they don't.
It varies a day. I'll lose about 1,000 the entire flock.
This is a terrible smell, I can tell you. It even hurts my eyes, to be honest.
Yeah, the ammonia will sting them a little bit.
I feel really bad. I'll be outside, okay?
Okay.
Craig, you said what's written here is far from reality. Exactly what is not true?
Raised cage-free, you saw it. That's what they call cage-free. You can cram them in there till they can't move, but if there's not a cage in there, they call them cage-free. And no hormones or steroids. It's been outlawed since the 70s. It means nothing. It's meaningless. Just saying, you know, like the sky's blue kind of thing. Is that going to grab your attention? Is it? I mean, really?
Actually, yes.
Yes,
I would say yes.
Yeah. The FDA or the USDA, who's ever in charge for the misbranding or mislabeling, needs to get in on this.
Now, the kicker is the USDA is not coming in here with their own third-party standards. They're taking the standards that the industry wrote for themselves, and they're just taking that checklist, and if Purdue is doing what Purdue says it's doing, they make 100. It's like you get a dishonest kid grading his own test paper. Look, Mama made 100, that kind of thing. That's the way I see it. It's a joke. Nothing wrong with anybody making money and nothing wrong with a corporation making money, but when you start walking on people's backs, it's a whole different story. Was it Kissinger that said, control the nations, control the oil, control the food, and you control the people? We're close.
Do you eat yourself? Or do you eat meat?
No.
Okay, now we're going to listen to a different... That just shows you how toxic and bad chicken is, whether it's the only... The trouble is people don't want to eat a toxic chicken or eggs, but that's what you're getting, and you're being lied to. Vegan is the way to go. Now we're going to hear a in-your-face challenge to Ted Cruz about some of his statements that are stupidly being put out there as an answer to terrorism.
Concerns. Let me ask you, how many Muslims are in America?
I don't know the number off the top of my head.
So you're saying that law enforcement should surveil a number of Muslims, and you don't even know how many Muslims are in America?
What I'm saying...
There are 3 million Muslims in America.
How is targeting Muslim neighborhoods constitutional?
You cite that program, but it, of course, has been disbanded. And a former supervisor of that program said that in 6 years, it never led to even one piece of intelligence, not an arrest, not a conviction.
Well, Senator, you know that surveillance program was in effect in New York. It has been disbanded, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. You also know it didn't lead to any leads, any intelligence tips. They said it didn't work.
In fact, the supervisor was quoted as saying that it involved paying undercover officers to sit in cafes frequented by Muslims, drinking tea and eating sweets at taxpayer expense.
We have a chief of police, one of the most respected chiefs of police, who was here earlier, who said there are no Muslim neighborhoods. It's not like Europe. It doesn't exist that way. It's impractical what you're suggesting. All also, it doesn't suggest it would lead to anything. It's more of a political point that you're making.
I have almost 1,000 Muslim officers in the NYPD. Ironically, when he's running around here, we probably have a few Muslim officers guiding him.
There are so many people that say that your comments are decidedly anti-Muslim and that you're playing right into the hands of ISIS, that you're giving them ammunition to come after us, to really take action against us. That you're just teeing it up for people to come after us.
And do you have to have any particular suspicion that they're being radicalized? Or is it just the mere fact that they're Muslims, in your mind, means police officers should be securing and patrolling those areas?
Faders for radical Islamic terrorists.
That's not a similar problem that we have here in the United States.
Of course it is. There are communities in America.
Name one community, one city, where we have a large group of radicalized Muslims.
10% of doctors in this country, I've read, are Muslim Americans. Muslim Americans are entrepreneurs. They are leaders in this country. Ted Cruz could not have it more wrong.
Yeah, I agree with that. Those are just some of the people within the media challenging him. Now let's challenge ourselves to understand what Alan Watts, one of the greatest philosophers in history, had to say on the idea of choice. Please listen, because it's the deeper meaning that reveals itself.
Your decisions come from. They pop up like hiccups. And when you make a decision, people have a great deal of anxiety about making decisions. Did I think this over long enough? Did I take enough data into consideration? And if you think it through, you find you never could take enough data into consideration. The data for a decision in any given situation is infinite. So what you do is you go through the motions of thinking out what you will do about this. But warriors are people who think of all the variables beyond their control and what might happen.
Choice is the act of hesitation that we make before making a decision. It is a mental wobbling. And so we are always in a dither of doubt as to whether we're behaving the right way, doing the right thing, and so on and so forth, and lack a certain kind of self-confidence. And if you see you lack self-confidence, you will make mistakes through sheer fumbling. If you do have self-confidence, you may get away with doing entirely the wrong thing. You have to regard yourself as a cloud in the flesh. Because you see, clouds never make mistakes. Did you ever see a cloud that was misshapen? Did you ever see a badly designed wave? No, they always do the right thing. But if you will treat yourself for a while as a cloud or wave and realize that you can't make a mistake, whatever you do, because even if you do something that seems to be totally disastrous, it'll all come out in the wash somehow or other. Then, through this capacity, you will develop a kind of confidence. And through confidence, you will be able to trust your own intuition. Now, this is the middle way of knowing it has nothing to do with your decision to do this or not. Whether you decide that you can't make a mistake or whether you don't decide it, it's true anyway. But you are like cloud and water. And through that realization, without overcompensating in the other direction, you will come to the point where you begin to be on good terms with your own being and to be able to trust your own brain.
Each of these lives is the right one. Every path is the right path. Everything could have been anything else, and it will have just as much.
More on Alan Watts on upcoming programs, but in this context, what would have changed in our lives if we would have given ourselves an opportunity to have viewed something as the other person, the other point of view? Can we stay neutral long enough without emoting without going into our hyper self-righteousness, our need. We're so programmed by the epigenetics of our conditioned self that rarely do you see reason used. And as a result, all the time, we're making decisions that later we think, shouldn't have said that, shouldn't have done it. Then why? Why didn't you? It was about choice, but what motivates choice? When the choice comes from the spiritual, authentic self, it's always the right choice. When it doesn't, it's never the right choice, even if we try to disguise it, hide it, write a new story around it, justify it, rationalize it. More on that on an upcoming topic. Now, the gentleman who called in the other day, at the end of the show, where I did not have an opportunity to respond, he made a comment that could be easily perceived as an extremely racist comment, or maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was just someone who was believing that the great minds of the past, like Galileo, were in a class by themselves, how they looked at the world, what they created, and that surely the Native Americans have nothing in common with them. And in this respect, he's absolutely right. George Washington said, "Indians and wolves are both beasts of prey, though they differ in shape." And Thomas Jefferson said, "If ever we are constrained to lift the hatchet against any tribe, we will never lay it down till that tribe is exterminated or driven beyond the Mississippi. In war they will kill some of us, but we shall destroy them all." Or Andrew Jackson, who said, "My original convictions upon this subject have been confirmed by the course of events of several years, and experiences every day adding to that strength, that those tribes cannot exist surrounded by our settlements and in continual contact with our civilization. That is certain. They have neither the intelligence, the industry, the moral habits, nor the desire of improvement, which are essential to any favorable change in their condition. Established in the midst of another and a superior race, and without appreciating the causes of their inferiority or seeking to control them, they must necessarily yield to the force of circumstances and long disappear." How about Abraham Lincoln? He frees the slaves. Surely he would have been equally as enthused towards justice for Native Americans. He said, "Ordered that of the Indians and a half-breed sentenced to be hanged by the military commission composed of Colonel Crooks, Lieutenant Colonel Marshall, Captain Grant, Captain Bailey, and Lieutenant Olin, and lately sitting in Minnesota, you caused to be executed on Friday the 19th day of December instant, the following names to wit." And that was the text from President Lincoln to General Sibley ordering the execution of American Indians in Minnesota. Did he care about their innocence or guilt? We do not know. We only care that he was not going to involve them in the same sense of looking at the circumstances of their life and what they were charged for. And one more that would align with you, sir. Theodore Roosevelt, President of the United States. "I don't go so far as to think that the only good Indians are dead Indians, but I believe 9 out of 10 are, and I shouldn't be like to inquire too closely into the case of the 10th. So on the one hand, you do have some very prominent people, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt. You have there 5 presidents of the United States that are on issue in alignment with you. But that does not make it true. Have you heard of Luther Standing Bear, a Lakota Sioux, who said, "I'm going to venture that the man who sat on the ground in this teepee meditating on life and its meaning, accepting the kinship of all creatures and acknowledging unity with the universe of things, was infusing into his being the true essence of civilization." How about Quanah Parker, Comanche, founder of the Native American church movement? "The white man goes into his church and talks about Jesus. the Indian goes into his teepee and talks about Jesus, talks with Jesus. Or Lame Deer, the Lakota Sioux. Before our white brothers arrived to make us civilized men, we didn't have any kind of prison. Because of this, we had no delinquents. Without a prison, there can be no delinquents. We had no locks nor keys, and therefore among us, there were no thieves. When someone was so poor that he couldn't afford a horse, a tent, or a blanket, he would, in that case, receive it all as a gift. We were too uncivilized to give great importance to civilized property. We didn't know any kind of money, and consequently the value of a human being was not determined by his wealth. We had no written laws laid down, no lawyers, no politicians, therefore we were not able to cheat and swindle one another. We were really in bad shape before the white men arrived, and I don't know how to explain how we were able to manage these fundamental things, so they tell us, are so necessary for civilized society. That was John Lame Deer, Sioux Lakota. I would hope that you would at least know of Chief Seattle. Back in 1866, he said, "Humankind has not woven the web of life. We are but one thread within it. Whatever we do to the web, we do to ourselves. All things are bound together. All things connect." Or Red Cloud, the Lakota Sioux, "I am poor and naked, but I am the chief of the nation. We do not want riches. We do not want to train our children except to do right. Riches would do us no good. We could not take them with us to the other side. We do not want riches. We want peace and love." And Black Elk, "Out of the Indian approach to life, there came a great freedom, an intense and absorbing respect for life, enriching faith in a supreme power, the principles of truth, honesty, and generosity, and equality, and brotherhood. That was our guide to mundane relations." He also said, "Grown men can learn very little from the hearts of themselves, but a great deal from the hearts of children, because they are pure. Therefore, the Great Spirit may show them many things which older men miss." From a great chief of the Miwok in 1795. "Once I was in Victoria and I saw a very large house. They told me it was a bank and that the white men placed their money there to be taken care of and that by and by they get it back with interest. We are Indians and we have no such bank, but we have plenty of money or blankets. We give them away to our chiefs and people, and by, they return them with interest, and our hearts feel good. Our way of giving is our bank." And this was from a Shawnee in 1792, Chicxiqua. "When a white army battles Indians and wins, it's called a great victory. But when it loses, it's called a massacre." And this has been passed down from the white buffalo calf woman. It's the Lakota instruction. And she says, "Whatever you do in life, do the very best you can, with both heart and mind. And if you do it that way, the power of the universe will come to your assistance in your heart and mind, and they're in unity. All of creation is related. The hurt of one is the hurt of all. And the honor of one is the honor of all. And whatever we do affects everything in the universe." And for 100 years at least, from 1700 to 1800, there was the Iraqi maxim that said, "In our very deliberation, we must consider the impact of our decisions on the next 7 generations. And then there was the Shanti Dakota. "It was our belief that the love of possessions is a weakness to be overcome. Its appeal is to the material part, and if allowed its way, it will in time disturb one's spiritual balance. Therefore, children must learn the beauty of generosity. They are taught to give what they prize most, that they may taste the happiness of giving. And from the Cree prophecy in the 19th century, when all the trees have been cut down, when all the animals have been hunted, when all the waters are polluted, when all the air is unsafe to breathe, only then will you discover you cannot eat money. And maybe you heard of Crazy Horse. This was just 4 days before he was murdered in 1877. The Red Nation shall rise again, and it shall be a blessing for the sick world, a world filled with broken promises, selfishness, and separations, a world longing for light again. I see a time of seven generations when all the colors of mankind will gather under the sacred tree of life, and the whole earth will become one circle. In that day, there will be those among the Lakota who will carry knowledge and understanding of unity among all living things, and the young white ones will come to those of my people and ask for this wisdom. I salute the light within your eyes, where the whole universe dwells. And when you're left at the center within you, and I'm at that place within me, we shall be one. So, sir, do those sound like savages? Does that sound like bigotry? Selfishness? Could you imagine a Sioux, Lakota, a Mohawk child who is happiest when giving their gifts to others? Compare that to 95% of young people today. Now, you made the mistake, I believe, of suggesting that we have not gained anything from the Native American experience. If only a little history was approached, you would have known that European civilization caused the death of about 40 million Native Americans. That's massive genocide. Benjamin Franklin was particularly influenced by Native American systems of governance. He wrote that the, quote, Six Nation tribes, the Iroquois, formed a union in such a manner as that it was subsisted for ages and appears indissolvable, end quote. Well, why was that important? Because he later wrote, Benjamin Franklin, quote, the idea of the federal government in which certain powers are given to a central government and all other powers are reserved for the states was borrowed from the Iraqi League of Nations. The U.S. Constitution was heavily influenced by the Iraqi Constitution that was based upon the four principles: peace, equality, justice, and the power of good minds. At the time of the colonization of the Americas, European medical practice had declined to barbarous protocols. By the time Europeans arrived, complex brain surgery was being performed among South American natives. In North America, sophisticated surgical instruments were invented for treating hemorrhoids. Indians invented the first forceps. They understood anatomy and complexities of the circulatory system, detoxification, more than anyone in Europe. By purging the body of poisons and removing fluids from the lungs and chest, they employed sutures from human hair and were expert at treating fractures. Also, they had a large pharmacopoeia of medicinal herbs and plants, such as willow bark that we know now today as aspirin for bringing down fever and killing pain. But theirs was more pure, more potent, less toxic. It was not uncommon to have those within the tribes have a background and knowledge of at least 100 to 200 herbs. They had a very advanced knowledge of anesthetics, performing surgical procedures while patients were left with no pain. In Europe, the most common anesthetic during that same period of time was a sharp blow to the head, trying to make the person unconscious by knocking them out. Native Americans created the first hypodermic needles from hollow bird bones to introduce herbal concoctions to relieve pain and introduce a natural medicine to a particular part of the body. Shoshone and nation invented oral contraceptives with herbs to prevent pregnancy. This is one of the reasons why the Spanish conquistadors preferred to be treated by native healers instead of the European counterparts. And the Navajo created one of the most sophisticated languages in the world, which is why they were employed by the military as code breakers. The Nazis sent spies posing as anthropologists to learn native languages but failed to crack their language. The Pima Indians invented a very complex and sophisticated irrigation canal system for farming that Americans settlers didn't know, and they used it. There was no such advanced irrigation system of canals in Europe. Native Central American calendars are unmatched by any other civilization in the world. This course required highly advanced mathematical skills. The first electroplating invented by the Moshi Indians was concocting a corrosive acidic solution with small traces of gold added to a gilt copper. Incas in the high Andean mountains invented freeze drying for storing potatoes and other foods, as a dehydrated powder could be stored for years. They had no such thing in Europe. The American Indians were the first in the world to extract sap from rubber trees for making clothes and toys and balls and other utilitarian items. The Olmecs in the Yucatan back in the 1700 BC, created the first rubber balloons. An all-natural people, the American Indians, practiced natural and ecological conservation. They understood the immense importance of educating your youth and the values of sustainability, the balance between humans and the natural world to assure survival. I could add a lot more, but if you want more reading, read my book, Secrets of the Great White Buffalo, on Native American history. I wrote two major books on Native Americans. So don't mind you calling in, but please do so by doing a little homework before you make a statement that degrades such a rich and diverse amount of knowledge input that the Native Americans gave us, and we gave them genocide in return. Not a good exchange, sir. Now, to an important issue, and this is the issue of the enormous power that the Jewish lobby has, but does not represent all Judaism. I did a really in-depth hour with a leading rabbi that represents thousands of rabbis who is anti-Zionist, pro-Israel, pro-Jews, pro-Judaism, but makes it clear that Judaism and Zionism are diametrically opposite. And what you see today in much of Israel, in virtually all of its policies, is Zionism. A lot of Jews are opposed to it. We never hear them. They never have a voice. This is their latest activity. The ones who have the power through AIPAC and the Jewish lobbies. This is from The Intercept, Robert McKay. Quote, University of California adopts policy linking anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. The regents of the University of California unanimously adopted a new policy on discrimination on Wednesday that links anti-Semitism to opposition to Zionism, the ideology asserting that Jewish people have a right to nation-state in historic Palestine. At a meeting in San Francisco, the University of California Board of Regents approved a working group's recommendations to set, quote, principles against intolerance that accepts the argument that manifestations of anti-Semitism have changed and result debates over Israel on college campuses and expressions of anti-Semitism are more coded and difficult to identify. In particular, quote, opposition to Zionism is often expressed in ways that are not simply statements of disagreement over politics or policy, but also assertions of prejudice and intolerance against Jewish people and culture. So now what they're saying is, if you have anything you want to say against Israel or its policies or in support of the Palestinians, you're anti-Semitic. And now there won't be any more debates. No tolerance on University of California campuses, and this is spreading. Counterpoint. This is from Chris Hedges, from Truthdig, Why I Support the BDS Movement, quote, "The Palestinians are poor. They are powerless. They have no voice or influence in the halls of power. They are demonized. They do not have well-heeled lobbyists doling out campaign contributions and pushing through pro-Palestinian legislation. No presidential candidate is appealing to donors, as Hillary Clinton did when she sent a letter to the media mogul Haim Saban denouncing critics of Israel by promising to advance the interests of Palestinian people. Palestinians, like poor people of color in the United States, are expendable. Justice for Palestine will never come from traditional governmental institutions or political parties that administer power. These institutions have surrendered to moneyed interests. Justice will come only from us. And the sole mechanism left to ensure justice for Palestine is to boycott investment and sanctions, the movement against Israel. Sanctions brought down the apartheid regime of South Africa, and they are what will bring down the apartheid regime of Israel. The DBA is nonviolent. It appeals to conscience, and it works. All Israeli products, including Jaffa citrus fruits, Ahava cosmetics, SodaStream drinks machines, Eden Springs bottled water, and Israel wine, must be boycotted. We must refuse to do business with Israeli service companies, and we must boycott corporations that do business with Israel, including Caterpillar, Hewlett Packard, Hyundai. We must put pressure on institutions from churches to universities to divest from Israel companies and corporations that have contracts with Israel. The struggle against apartheid in South Africa was long and hard. This struggle will be too. Gaza, a year after Israeli carried out a devastating bombing campaign that lasted almost 2 months, is in ruins. Most of the water is unsafe to drink. There are power outages for up to 12 hours a day. 40% of the 1.8 million inhabitants are unemployed, including 67% of the youth, the highest youth unemployment rate in the world. Of the 17,000 homes destroyed by Israel in the siege, not one has been rebuilt. 60,000 people remain homeless. Only a quarter of the promised $3.5 billion in aid from international donors has been delivered, much of it diverted to the Palestinian Authority, the Israeli puppet regime that governs the West Bank. And no one in Washington, Republican or Democrat, will defy the Israeli lobby. No one will call for justice or stay the Israeli killing machine. U.S. senators, including Bernie Sanders, at the height of the Israeli bombardment last summer, voted unanimously to defend the Israeli slaughter of people with no army, no navy, no air force, no mechanized units, no artillery, and no command and control. It was a vote worthy of the old Soviet Union. Every senator held out his or her tin cup to the Israeli lobby and chose naked self-interest over justice. Israel, like the United States, is poisoned by the psychosis of permanent war. It, too, is governed by a corrupt oligarch elite for whom war has become a lucrative business. It, too, has deluded itself into carrying out war crimes and then playing the role of victim. Israel's system of education and the press, again mirrored in the United States, have indoctrinated Israelis into believing that they have a right to kill anyone whom the state condemns as a terrorist. And Israel's most courageous human rights campaigners and intellectuals and journalists are slandered and censored in their own country, just as American critics of Norman Finkelstein, Max Blumenthal, and Noam Chomsky are in the United States. Those who become addicted to the wielding of the instruments of war, blinded by hubris and a lust for power, eventually become war's victims. This is as true for Israel as the United States. In conclusion, Israel's goal was to make life a living hell for all Palestinians, ethnically cleansing as many as they can and subduing those who remain. The peace process is a sham. It has led to Israel's seizure of more than a half the land on the West Bank, including the aquifers, and herding Palestinians into squalid, ringed ghettos, while turning Palestinian land and homes over to Jewish settlers. Israel is expanding settlements, especially in the East Jerusalem area. Racial laws, once championed by the right-wing demagogue Meir Kahani, openly discriminate against Israeli Arabs and Palestinians. In Gaza, Israel practices an even more extreme form of cruelty. It employs a mathematical formula to limit outside food deliveries to Gaza to keep the caloric level of the 1.8 million Palestinians just above starvation. It has left 80% of Palestinians in Gaza dependent upon Islamic charities and outside aid to survive. And the periodic military assaults on Gaza, euphemistically called mowing the lawn, are carried out every few years to ensure the Palestinians remain broke, terrified, and destitute. There have been three Israeli attacks on Gaza since 2008, each more violent and indiscriminate than the last. And that is a point of view from Chris Hedges. I'm Gary Knoll. I want to thank you all for listening today, and we look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day.